E-cigarettes have garnered lots of attention since they first came out. Proponents say that it's a great alternative to tobacco for people who are nicotine addicts. E-cigarettes can help people get off of regular cigarettes that can cause lung problems and cardiovascular problems, and can help them to reduce the use of tobacco cigarettes. Those who oppose e-cigarettes have several arguments against them. First, e-cigarettes perpetuate someone's nicotine addiction. Second, the manufacturers of e-cigarettes are targeting their marketing to young people, ensuring that another generation is addicted to nicotine. And finally, there's little research on the effects of e-cigarettes on the body. And recent research has documented that the flavorings of e-cigarettes that target younger people are associated with a rare, damaging lung condition referred to as popcorn lung. Despite these concerns, some mental health professionals are proposing e-cigarettes as a harm reduction alternative to tobacco cigarettes among people with serious mental illness and substance users. And here to talk with us about this issue are two guests today for Health Cetera. Kevin McGeer is Associate Professor of Nursing at New York City College of Technology, City University of New York, and Associate Clinical Professor of Nursing at the University of California, San Francisco. He has over 40 years of experience in providing behavioral health services in Boston, San Francisco, and New York. Kevin, I see that you're bicoastal, and I very much appreciate your coming on to Health Styles today.
Yes. Great to be here.
And Helen Redman is a licensed clinical social worker and harm reduction specialist at Community Access in New York City. She's been working with drug users for over 15 years. She's also adjunct faculty at the Silver School of Social Work, New York University, and is an independent journalist who writes about drugs for Alternet, Al Jazeera, and Socialist Worker. Helen, it's a pleasure to have you today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
So let's start off talking about what exactly are e-cigarettes and this idea of vaping. I understand it's called vaping. It sounds sort of cool, actually.
Kevin, Ellen, I think you should describe that.
Pardon me? It's pretty simple. I mean, the way an electronic cigarette works, there is a kind that's called cig-alike, meaning very much like a cigarette, and it contains a battery. And when the person takes a drag on the electronic cigarette, it activates a heating element, and that atomizes liquid nicotine, which is in a cartridge, and that produces a vapor, and that vapor is inhaled into the lungs, and it's a nicotine cartridge. It contains nicotine, and that's essentially how it works. It's pretty straightforward.
Have you ever tried one?
I have, but not... Having been a smoker and not liking inhalation, it wasn't really a great experience. But I some of the people that I work with and some friends have found it very helpful in lots of ways, which I'm sure we'll get into.
So, and this recent research on the popcorn lung, it ends up being the flavoring that's in the e-cigarette. So you can buy them in different flavors?
Yes. I mean, there are, I understand... not an expert on the electronic devices, but there are up to 7,000 different flavors.
Come on.
And you're correct that it is the flavoring that was identified in the, quote, popcorn study, popcorn lung study. I think it's important, Diana, to talk about what was omitted from that particular piece of research, and it's very important. The offending ingredient was diacetyl, which is known to cause a serious lung illness in people who are working with manufacture of buttered popcorn. What is significant about the study is that they failed to mention that the same element appears in regular cigarettes at 750 times the dose than appears in the electronic devices. The other piece of information that they didn't mention in the study is that the offending agent has never been documented to cause lung disease in smokers. So while clearly there is a lot of concern around the safety related to electronic cigarettes, There is no documented evidence that we are aware of that actually links any actual adverse consequences of electronic cigarette use with people who are using those devices.
So you both are working with the seriously mentally ill and substance using populations. So tell us why this is an issue of that smoking is an issue of concern or tobacco use is an issue of concern in this population.
Well, the one statistic that I think I would hope would be shocking to people is this statistic, and this is from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And so according to them, smoking kills about 200,000 people with a mental illness every year, and about 450,000 people in the United States die from smoking-related illnesses every year. So half of the people who are dying from smoking-related illnesses are people with some diagnosed mental illness. That could be schizophrenia, it could be bipolar depression. So the people that Kevin and I work with feel the effects disproportionately, the morbidity and the mortality from smoking. And the rates of smoking among people with a diagnosed mental illness is something like 70% higher than adults who have no diagnosis of mental illness. Among people with a diagnosis of schizophrenia, it's even higher. So we deal with the effects of smoking in our day-to-day work. It's you cannot escape it. And we know that people with a diagnosed mental illness already die on average for anywhere from 10 studies are it's a wide range, but we know that people with a diagnosed mental illness die on average 10 to 20 years earlier than those not diagnosed. And smoking is a contributing factor to that. So for us, we have to do something about this issue, and because it affects the people we work with very profoundly. And vaping is a new way to address smoking.
So Kevin, tell us about, you both are coming from a harm reduction perspective. Tell us about that perspective.
Sure. Harm reduction, as you probably know, Diana, was essentially named in the late '80s, early '90s. It very much comes out of the needle exchange effort that occurred both in Europe and here. And very simply, you know, the goal of harm reduction is to reduce harm. Now, initially, the concept was controversial, particularly when it addressed issues having to do with substance users. As I'm sure you know, and mm-hmm. most of your audience probably knows, the legacy in substance abuse treatment, was an abstinence-only model. The harm reductions came along and basically conveyed that people change over longer periods of time, and that while people are engaged in self-harming behaviors, that societies and health systems can endeavor to essentially find ways to reduce harm, to accept the fact that people will unfortunately engage in behaviors that will be harmful, but how can we reduce those harms? So essentially what we're looking at with respect to taking that concept into tobacco use, particularly tobacco use with the population that we work with, is what are the strategies that can work with individuals, accepting the fact that they probably will continue to use nicotine at a significant rate, at a significantly higher rate than the general population. We accept that fact, and we can also talk a little bit about why that might be, why they're continuing to use nicotine. But accept the fact that they are doing that and begin to look at the strategies that do work. I think there is some good news. We've got a variety of strategies which are well documented, from cessation, the nicotine replacement therapies, the medication bupropion and Chantix. They all have had some positive effect in the population, particularly as health systems have ramped up to deliver these strategies to the seriously mentally ill and substance users. However, the data indicates that it's still a fraction of the population, unlike the general population, who have responded more favorably. Our population have not responded to those strategies in the same way. We continue to endorse them. We continue to use them. Our approach is that we want to offer to our client population a variety of options, give them choices, the same choices the general population has. And, of course, in the general population, there is now up to 12% of the population who have tried electronic cigarettes, between 3 and 4% currently are using. We have no data on how much use around electronic devices are being utilized within the SMI population. But we'd like
seriously
to,
mentally you know, ill population. Mm-hmm.
Correct. We'd like to, again, advocate that that population have access while science and biomedical services continue to evaluate the continued safety and use of this of these devices with the population.
So let me go back to something you said, and that is that we could be talking about why the seriously mentally ill population uses tobacco more than the general population, smokes tobacco more. Why? What do we know about that?
Well, we actually know quite a bit about nicotine, and one of the things as harm reductionists that we're trying to do when it comes to nicotine is destigmatize nicotine. It's been thought of probably for at least 50, 60 years as a dirty drug, kind of like heroin. And really, one of the things we want to do is rescue nicotine from this stigma and talk about the real benefits of nicotine. You can call it a drug. I like to refer to it as a medication because you really have to ask yourself, why would somebody engage in habit for 15, 20, 25, 30 years, knowing full well, because I think it's impossible in this country for any smoker to not understand the very real risks of smoking tobacco. What is it that would keep somebody going back year after year after year and experiencing smoking-related illnesses? So that is really nicotine. It is nicotine. And for the people that we work with, people who have a serious mental illness and drug users, I'm talking about the licit as well as the illicit drugs, is first of all, nicotine acts as a stimulant and a sedative. And one of the things it does really well is it reduces anxiety. It reduces depression. And if you've felt anxious or depressed, to alleviate that state or minimize it, it's enormously important, right? Who wants to feel those kinds of states? So you take a drag of a cigarette, and within 10 seconds, nicotine gets into the brain. So it works very quickly versus taking a medication, an anti-anxiety medication. So anti-anxiety, antidepressant, it increases memory, it increases concentration. Another benefit for people who have a mental illness, it increases their concentration, and it mitigates the side effects of medication. So for many of the people that Kevin and I work with, they're on many psychotropic medications, and one of the major side effects of many of these medications is sedation. And what nicotine does is it also increases energy. And that's really important because who wants to be tired all day? So it energizes people. It relieves feelings of anxiety and depression. And for people with a mental illness, that is really, really huge. So that's why people go back to this drug over and over and over again. It's really not a mystery when you strip away all of the hysteria and the idea of, like, this is a terrible, dirty drug, and you look at the real positive effects. I'll just add, Diane, that nicotine is being used to study, is used in studies with people who have Alzheimer's because it helps with memory and concentration. It's being used to look at Tourette's, Parkinson's, a whole number of diseases, also obesity, because we know another positive effect of nicotine for some people is it's an appetite suppressant.
Well, I want to just add on, Diana, to what Helen said with respect to nicotine. The obvious question is, well, if nicotine has all these benefits, why not advocate and strongly encourage the population to use the current devices like the usual, the conventional NRTs. And
NRTs?
What
are NRTs?
Nicotine replacement therapies such as the patch or the gum.
Great, thank you.
And some of the population does use those. I don't have the data at hand. My general sense is that most of our population have not signed up, although they have tried these devices. They often do not find them satisfying. So I think the other piece here, and in fact, we also don't know whether the population will accept and sustain the use of electronic devices. We don't have that information at this point. The possibility is that we know with respect to the addiction that the act of smoking, the sensory motor aspect of smoking, is very much part of the ritual and part of the addiction. So vaping most likely mirrors the actual act of cigarette smoking. That's partly what we want to look at, you know, with the population. Will they accept, will they sustain the use?
Yeah, this is this is actually quite fascinating. I want to share with you a story, but before I do, let me just remind listeners that you're listening to Health Cetera on WBAI 99.5 FM New York. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program, and I'm talking today with Kevin McGurr and Helen Redmond about e-cigarettes and their use in the seriously mentally ill population and drug-using population. And so the story I want to share with you, it took place probably 30 years ago, and I was working with a young man who had been addicted to some substances and had successfully gotten off of, it was some kind of a narcotic, and I don't remember the details of it, but he had successfully gotten off, and he was a chain smoker and drank coffee all day long. And I suggested that, you know, he might want to just try to clean up his life in general. And it was so overwhelming to him. The idea of giving up cigarettes was more than he could handle, even the coffee for that matter. And I never quite understood it until this explanation that you all had given today. It makes all the sense in the world. And I also have to admit to a bit of a bias because I have a family member who has a smoking problem and has severe arterial insufficiency. And, of course, the first thing he was told was, you've got to quit smoking. And so I'm sitting here thinking, okay, so if the lung problems aren't enough, then let's get some arterial insufficiency in here. But then when you talk about the harm reduction approach, you're absolutely right, that what good is it for me to try to feel miserable and not even want to live, perhaps, when the long-term picture might be that I get some lung problems and some cardiovascular problems. But for right now, it's helping me to make it through the day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and there is some literature, and we should acknowledge, Diana, that currently, and you're probably aware, that the literature against vaping is increasing exponentially.
Yes.
And the literature in favor, much of it is actually coming from outside the U.S. in Europe, and some of it is looking at the benefits in terms of improving blood pressure, decreasing, you know, asthmatic incidents with you know, former smokers, those who have switched to electronic devices. What doesn't seem to be highlighted as much is the fact that there are some benefits. There's a lot of benefits with respect to moving to non-combustible tobacco. I mean, another concern that we hear a lot about, and we, again, take the concern seriously with the general population, and again, it's a very mixed blessing. Perhaps we could also see it as a very positive effect that youth, of course, have significantly decreased in their tobacco use. Mm. At the same time, we also find that they have increased in their use of electronic devices. Mm. Now, we don't have any definitive cause and effect. Seems to be likely that there's a correlation. And, of course, that leads the anti-vaping advocates to become alarmed around young people becoming, you know, addicted to nicotine. The concern, of course, is it's the old argument that if they become, quote, hooked on nicotine, that this become a gateway back or into tobacco. Currently, there's no data around that. Mm-hmm. I would question, given the amount of education that society has very successfully achieved over the last 30, 40 years, that the younger folks are very educated about tobacco and they are responding. Mm. But children, young people, teenagers particularly, they like to experiment with drugs. And that's a reality that I guess as a society that we're still coping with respect to, you know, drug use.
So people who have mental illnesses are free to buy an electronic cigarette, aren't they?
Sure. One of the issues with that, though, is if you look at, I think it's interesting to look at the social determinants of smoking, at least in the United States. And when you look at who is still smoking after decades of public health interventions that have been very successful with certain demographics in the United States, we actually see a picture that is skewed by race and class. And so the prevalence of adults who smoke by race and ethnicity, we see that 32% of people who are still smoking are American Indian, 23% are African American, and then the numbers go down. So it's people of color and people who have been historically oppressed who continue to smoke at really high rates. And if we look at the numbers by education, we see that people who have less education have higher rates of smoking, something like 46% of smokers only have GEDs. The higher you go up, PhDs, their rates are really, really tiny. So looking at the social determinants, it's poor people, it's people of color who continue to smoke. And so we have to address that in terms of, you know, having available to people who don't have a lot of money. And these are groups that don't have as much money as, for example, say middle-class people do. And for our people, many of them live on Social Security, so their check might be $800 a month, and they have to do a lot with a little money. On average, it is cheaper to vape, but the startup costs are significant. And one of the things that we've found in our work is that often the first, if you buy a Cigalike, it might be Blue, whatever brand. It might not be the brand that is really going to work for you. So you need to kind of check out several different brands and see if you like the amount of vapor. There's a thing called a throat hit that smokers really enjoy. There's cartridges with anywhere from no nicotine up to 20-some milligrams. So you need to kind of play around with it. Well, for people who don't have a lot of disposable income, that becomes much harder, right?
So, and I think what I would add to what Helen's saying, Diana, is that, yes, I mean, in the long run, it is cheaper. But when you are on a limited budget, it's very hard to really conceptualize that this is going to be, you know, more cost-effective for me. And, of course, many of the clients that we serve, you probably know, they're buying Lucy's, you know, individual cigarettes from the corner store because they can afford 25 cents to buy the cigarette rather than buying a whole pack. And that's not going to get you into the electronic device market.
So this is very interesting. So my question to you would be then, are you advocating that it be treated as a drug, and if I'm on, for example, on Medicaid for my coverage, that Medicaid cover electronic cigarettes for people with mental illness?
Well, I personally would endorse that. In England, the National Health Service will be a covered item like other smoking aids like the patch, the medications, and the gum. It will be part of the formulary. And I personally, this is my own personal view, not that of my agency, mm-hmm. I I think that would be a huge life improvement if people could go to the pharmacy and get them as they would the patches and the gums. Because really, what we're talking about, Diana, this is a revolutionary breakthrough in terms of treating nicotine dependence. I want to come back on what Kevin said about the ritual of smoking, especially for people who have a serious mental illness. The ritual of smoking has enormous importance. It is it's a marker of time. A lot of the people that we work with don't have jobs, and so it's a way to mark time. I'm sure you know this, but smoking is also very social. Mm-hmm. People lend each other cigarettes, they go outside and smoke, they take a smoking break. So there's a social aspect to it that's really important that I don't think is going to go away. And what vaping does is it keeps those rituals intact, the hand-to-mouth, inhalation, exhalation, and it delivers nicotine in a much, much safer way. And we're talking about potentially saving hundreds of thousands of lives. And that's why, for me, this hysteria that we're seeing in the United States against vaping. I mean, some of the people who are opposed to vaping, they're quite happy to support legislation that would make it more difficult for people to access electronic cigarettes. And that is problematic because these devices, I'm convinced, will save hundreds of thousands of lives. That's what we're talking about.
So
if I can add in there, Diana, just to go back, Helen referenced the National Health Service in the UK. I think we're unfortunately very far from Medicaid endorsing, you know, electronic device use for any population in the U.S. But I think our public health system really needs to look very closely at why is it that the United Kingdom, not a backwater nation, has endorsed the use of this device. They convened an international panel of experts that looked at the myriad list of harms created by a variety of tobacco delivery systems, and they rated the electronic devices as in the lower rung of harms, claiming that they're 95% safer than the known harms from combustible tobacco.
So you all are holding a conference on April 21st on this topic, are you not?
That's correct. Yes, we are.
Tell us about it.
Well, we're bringing together a number of national and international experts on this question. We are bringing Ricardo Pelosa is coming from Italy, and he is the director of the Institute of Internal Medicine and Clinical Immunology at the University of Catania. And he has done some of the most cutting-edge studies. He's actually done a study on helping persons diagnosed with schizophrenia transition to electronic cigarettes. So he's going to be talking about that study and then also about the safety aspects of electronic cigarettes. We have Shadi Chamaneh. She is she has a new title, but her former title was director of clinical and scientific affairs at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. She's going to be talking about some of the other smoking cessation devices, and in particular, what the NYC Department of Health and Mental Hygiene is trying to do to reach out to smokers to help reduce the rates of smoking among these two populations that we're talking about, people who are using drugs and then people who have a mental illness. We also have Michael Siegel, and he's a physician at Boston University in community health sciences. And he has a blog that I would recommend to all of your listeners, and it's called The Rest of the Story, Tobacco News Analysis and Commentary. And we'll have several other speakers, but some of the sessions we will be looking at the efficacy of nicotine patches and medications. Of course, one of the main topics is going to be mental illness and nicotine use, as well as safety. we'll be talking about the regulation of electronic cigarettes. It's also very controversial, and some of the other controversies around e-cigarettes. So really, this is a conference for everybody to attend.
So it's open to the public?
Absolutely, yes.
And where is it?
It's at my college here in Brooklyn at 300 J Street. Probably anyone who is interested, Diana, can email me. Shall I give people
my
email address if they want more information?
Mm-hmm.
It's basically my first initial and last name, K. McGirr, McGirr, at CityTech, CityTech, dot CUNY, CUNY, dot EDU.
And one more time. Give it one more time.
K. McGirr, KMCGIRR, at CityTech.CUNY.edu.
Yes, well, and that was Kevin McGirr, Associate Professor of Nursing at New York City College of Technology, where this conference will be held. He's also Associate Clinical Professor of Nursing at the University of California, San Francisco. And Kevin, thank you so much for joining me today on Health Styles. This has been fascinating.
Thank you so much, Diana.
And Helen Redman is a licensed clinical social worker and a harm reduction specialist at Community Access and an adjunct faculty at the Silver School of Social Work at New York University. Helen, it's been a pleasure to have you on today. I've been fascinated by this discussion.
Thank you very much.
And for those of you who are listening and are interested in attending this conference on e-cigarettes, and the conference is focused on e-cigarettes and the mental health population or not specific to that population?
Very specific to that population.
Great. That conference will take place on April 21st at New York City College of Technology. And again, you can, if you're interested, email Kevin McGirr at kmcgirr at citytech.cuny.edu. I'm Diana Mason. You're listening to HealthCetera on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City.